Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes. This is the audio diary of my life. I think it's the 25th today of June. June's just passed in a flash. They did say that time was going to speed up, didn't they? It has absolutely zoomed by. Today, I'm not quite sure what the time is, but it's probably something like 7 o'clock in the morning. And there's a sort of overcast with a little bits of blue coming in. It's very mild, warmer than it was yesterday, so I'm back in shorts, which is very nice. Thank you very much. Get the old legs, the pins out, as they say. We had some friends over yesterday, our friend Ed and his girlfriend Abby. It was lovely to have them over. We strolled down to the seafront and had some chips, which is always nice as a bit of a change. Always wary about having chips because they cooked in sunflower oil, so just a small portion of those. But it was very nice, although the weather was really bleak and it would have been lovely to have sat on the beach, gone for a stroll. Yes, it was overcast and windy. It was really quite obtuse. However, we did go to a place which has a grass sward. And we, Julia brought her little boy with her and we were playing catch. We took a tennis ball down and we just had a bit of fun. It was very lovely. And then we came back, was going to make them a coffee, but they had a 2-hour journey ahead of them. So that was that really. So that was nice. And yesterday I was finishing off. I was playing around with some ideas for the book cover on Biggleswick, and also I was drawing a map. I wanted to put in the frontispiece, which has now been obsessing, that was the word I was looking for, with the frontispiece. And I thought, what can I put? And I thought, well, I know, a map of the town centre of Biggleswick, so that as the reader, should they wish to, they can see where the places are in relation to others, as I saw them in my mind as I was writing the book. And so I've got a rough idea, and I've just got to try and work out how I'm going to present that, whether it be a line drawing or what, I don't know. Anyway, I will work on that a little bit later, perhaps today, and have another sort of play with the cover. I'm only getting ideas into layout. I've got to go and take the proper picture and what have you. But yeah, I also wrote off to ask for a quote, although I haven't had it yet, for a hardback edition with a dust cover on a cloth cover. You know, the dust cover goes off and then you have this sort of cloth hardback covering with certain type of paper in black and white on the inside with a coloured cover. So I'm just waiting now to see if they'll come back and then work out what the cost would be for X many books. It'll be a fair old whack, I should think, because it would be the prestigious version. But I know a number of people have got in touch and said that they would like to have a hardback. And I was looking at the quality of Dr. Laurie's book with this company that I've written to over the Lulu or the Amazon books. And the Amazon ones are just glued, even the hardbacks are just glued, whereas this one's stitched. Now, you know, it's a more expensive process, but it will last a hell of a lot longer and the pages won't fall out, because when they're stitched, the pages, as I understand it, are looped around the stitching, so they don't come loose. Now, I mean, gluing and stitching is as old as the hills, and they've been doing both. I'm not saying that the Amazon books are any less in terms of gluing or any less glued than any other book that's done. Probably not. It's just I quite like the fact that the hardback ones are not glued. It's a sign of, you know, it's just a bit more quality. And I think there is a sort of sense that if you believe that your work is worth the effort, then I don't know. I mean, people will always want something cheap, of course, and there will be the others that will always want a better edition. I absolutely get that, and the idea would be to offer both. Anyway, it's at the investigation stage, really, to see which is the best way of doing it. A lot of people will probably advise me one way and others will advise me another way, and, you know, you've got to make up your own mind, haven't you? It's an unusual book because it's a novel with these truth bombs in it. Well, you may not get, you know, you may say it's all fancy and they're not truth, that they're a completely conspiratorial rubbish. Well, that also may be true, of course. Anyway, we work on it. We work on it and we'll do our best to get round to it. Just drinking a cup of coffee. And had these lovely books from one of my viewers who sent in, Joe, her name was, AG Street Books. And this one, I was looking at this one that came, this was printed in 1949, I think. And it's called Round the Year on the Farm. And I love these sort of books because they take you back, really, before the big industrial, well, it was 1949, so it sort of had started, but even so, before we got into the 70s and 80s and farms were really going into the petrochemical farming business. It's got here, what I like about hardback books, second-hand books, is the bits of pieces that you find in it. So this has got Miss Dorothy Smith, New Cottages, Rothersthorpe, Northampton. Is that Rothersthorpe? I don't know where that is. It's somewhere. And one presumes that in 1949 that she wrote her name and address in it. And they have a frontispiece here, which is a picture of a farm, quite a modern looking farm actually, and it says, "A man and his beasts make a man and his home." This is printed by the Oxford University Press, and there's a foreword in here which is interesting. It says, printed in 1946 in Great Britain. And I was trying to work out the difference between forward. Forwards, as I understand it, are those things that are written by somebody else, generally. So I'm not quite sure if this is written by somebody else, this one. It says, "There are two great difficulties in writing a correct calendar of farming. The first is this is different from any other kind of calendar. The second is it varies according to the district." And that makes a lot of sense to me. But it's interesting that this foreword, I think, has been written by him. So there we are. Let's have a look what we've got up. Chapter 1. So there's this lovely picture. Bear in mind it's 1949. Wheat drilling, tractor hauling drill, horses pulling harrow. So this is a point in history where the horses were still working on the farms, and the introduction of tractors immediately after the Second World War were coming more on stream. Now I imagine that's sort of the time when the farms were at their most productive until the horses disappeared, because horses have huge advantages over tractors because they can go on different types of land without impacting it. And tractors, of course, can have other advantages over horses by pulling very heavy machinery, and they can work 24/7 unless they fall apart, but you know, there's lots of different pros and cons for both, of course. So anyway, this is in October, so I should just read a little bit from this. It says, "October is a busy month for any farmer. Of course, every farmer has one advantage over most people. As long as he remains a farmer, he can never be out of work. On every day of the year, he has only to go outside his house, and there in the fields and the farm buildings, he will see hundreds of jobs waiting to be done. But in October, there always seems to be 3 months' work to be done in one. The two most important jobs are to finish the harvesting of last year's crops and to begin preparations for next year's harvest. All the grain is now in stacks or ricks and thatched safe from the rain. The potatoes were dug in September and are now stored in pits or clamps. And the apples have been sold, stored, and made into cider. But there are two crops still to harvest, both root crops. One is mangolds and the other is sugar beet. The mangolds have been grown for cow feed, so that the cows should have some moist, fresh food when winter begins the good grass in the pastures to an end. What? Yeah, brings the good grass, that's what it says. They are now huge yellow roots with dark green leaves, and they must be pulled up and stored before the winter frosts can spoil them. So some of the farm men go out into the mangold field each morning and pull up the roots and chop off the leaves with a long knife. Then others come with horses and carts and haul the topped roots to a clamp or pit, which may be either in the farmyard or at the edge of the field near the gate to the road. The mangold pit is really not a pit at all, it's but a heap of roots, rather like a long railway embankment, about 12 feet high. The heap is covered with a short straw, about a foot thick, to protect the roots from frost, and then thatched with long wheat straw to keep them dry. Imagine that they go to the trouble of thatching over the top, because these days you just probably pull a big tarpaulin over them. In very cold districts in the north, the final covering is made of soil instead of thatch. Well, that makes sense. On rich land, mangolds can yield a crop of nearly 100 tons per acre, but a fair average for the whole country would be about 40 tons. Most dairy farmers grow about 1 acre of mangolds for every 8 cows they keep, so that on a farm that has a fairly large herd, say 40 cows, it's interesting they say that's a large herd of 40 cows, mangold pulling and hauling is a big job. Yes, so what have they just said there? Most dairy farmers grow an acre for every 8 cows. 2 eighths are 24, 4 eighths are 48. So 4 acres would do 40 cows. That's quite a lot of, say, 5 acre field, for sake of argument, if I've got that right. Then 5 acres of mangolds would take a lot to feed the cows, presumably during the winter, when the grass is low or the cows are in, I'm guessing. Sugar beet, it says, is a comparatively new crop for British farming. Until the Great War of 1914 to 18, Britain bought nearly all her sugar from countries overseas, but the shortage of sugar during the war made the government decide to try and grow some of our sugar at home. So, by guaranteeing a profitable price, they introduce farmers here to grow sugar beet, and today there are some sugar beet to be found on most farms. Sugar beet are the same plant family as mangolds, but are much more difficult to harvest because of their shape. A mangold is a globe shaped and grows most of its root out of the ground. But although a sugar beet has the same leaves as a mangold, its root is just like a parsnip, tapering to a point where almost the whole of it is buried in the earth. A man can pull up a mangold with one hand and cut off the leaves with a knife in his other hand fairly quickly. It's a bit like harvesting tobacco in some way, except it's not the root you're after, of course. But when he pulls at the sugar beet, the leaves break off and the root stays fast in the ground. Oh dear. So a ploughshare or some lifting iron implement has been drawn through the ground about 8 inches down in order to loosen the soil around the roots. Then the men can pull them up. But even then, the leaves must be cut off much more carefully than mangold leaves. With mangold leaves, you just cut off the leaves above the root. With sugar beet, you must cut off a disc off the root attached to the leaves. This top piece doesn't contain much sugar and isn't worth the cost of carriage to the sugar factory. I see, so you're saving a bit of money there by not bulking up your load. For the sugar beet does not stay on the farm, as mangolds do. They go by train or lorry to the factory where their sugar is extracted and refined. Perhaps someday a little of it comes back to the farm with the groceries from the town. So there we are, there's a little insight into that. And I know that Bury St Edmunds has a sugar beet factory, as indeed does one in... what's it called? I've been there. Can't remember the name of the town. It's near Nottingham. It's just the other side of Nottingham, a little town. Well, not a little town. What is it called? Oh, that's irritating. Nice town, nice ancient market town with the market square, actually, where the English Civil War, bits of the English... I think there's the English Civil War Centre there. I can't remember the name of the sodding town now. There's a little version, not version, but there's a village or a small town. It's a village in... I keep wanting to say Warwick, but it's not Warwick, but it's something like that. In East Sussex, there's a little... Oh, it's gone. It's gone. It's gone. Never mind. Anyway, there we are. So, sugar beet. It's quite new. And we, when Julia and I go to Dora's Dairy, we give the cows a little bit of sugar beet when they come in to have their milking. Just a little bit, keep them occupied. But I don't think John grows mangolds. Pretty certainly doesn't. I think it's all grass-fed. And I don't think he brings it in. And I don't know whether they still do this on farms, grow mangolds. You don't see them very often. And feed them to the cattle. But it would be worth trying that old-fashioned method if ever Julia and I manage to get a farm, which you never know what's round the corner. And it would be lovely to experiment with some of these older traditions and compare it, really. I certainly won't want to be buying in artificials and things and these, you know, these horrible feeds. But anyway, there we go. I thought I'd read a bit of that. I hope that was enjoyable. I shall get off now. Things to do, people to see, phone calls to make, letters to write. All that kind of malarkey. And a video to make, of course. So, thank you for listening if you did, and I will catch up with you probably tomorrow. Till then, toodle-pip.